seeing those heart-rending scenes of those anguished New Yorkers holding up pictures of their lost, missing loved ones. It looked very familiar. Los desaparecidos, the disappeared, the tens of thousands of victims of right-wing regimes in Latin America backed up by our own government. What we need to do is redefine security. I've traveled the Middle East for 20 or 30 years, and the more the United States has militarized the region, the less and less secure we have been.
From the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. Headlines and highlights for the week ending Saturday, September 22nd, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this one-hour look back at the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, we'll examine the racist backlash against Arab Americans in the days since September 11th. Professor Steven Zunis speaks about the role of U.S. foreign policy in the terrorist attacks. And Brian Wilson, Vietnam vet, speaks of the need for a peaceful resolution to the current conflict with Afghanistan. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now, headlines for the week ending Saturday, September 22nd, 2001. Three activists accused of trespassing at California's Vandenberg Air Force Base in May had their charges dismissed on Monday, September 17th. The arrests stemmed from a week of actions on the base to protest the development of the Star Wars missile defense program.
This is stuff that happened last week, World Trade Center and Pentagon. It just shows that the system, you know, if somebody wants to, you know, attack America, you know, they can do it without missile defense. So it just shows that the system that they want to throw in place is, it's invalid. If somebody wants to attack us, they can do it other ways.
23 people were arrested at the main gate action. A group of four activists were arrested on a county beach outside the base property. One man had earlier accepted a plea bargain and is now on probation. Another group of six people from the Los Angeles Catholic Workers were charged with double trespass and conspiracy for hiking deep into Vandenberg's satellite launch zones. Two people from that group pled guilty at arraignment, and the other four were found guilty of conspiracy and two counts of trespassing at a trial in early August. All four face sentencing on October 15th. Meanwhile, 15 Greenpeace activists and two journalists are facing a possible 6 years in prison on felony charges in connection with a nonviolent protest which delayed a Star Wars missile test for 40 minutes on July 14th. Their trial begins September 25th in Los Angeles. Jim Costner, the man who smashed a marble statue of Christopher Columbus inside San Jose City Hall last March, pleaded no contest to felony vandalism in court on Monday, September 17th. The plea follows a decision to represent himself in court after a scheduling conflict arose with his attorney, and a request for more time was denied. In the attack on the statue, the face and legs were damaged, and it has been estimated at $65,000 to fix. Costner asked the court for probation, but the district attorney's office is seeking a sentence of more than a year in state prison. He faces a maximum of 3 years in prison at a sentencing hearing scheduled for October 9th. Under the orders of the state prosecutor for Milan, Stefano D'Ambrosio, Italian authorities carried out about 100 raids in 20 cities across the country on the morning of Tuesday, September 18th, in which they confiscated files and computer equipment. 60 people were taken in for questioning in a search for suspected anarchists. The state prosecutor is conducting an investigation against the movement Solidarieta Internacional, which had actively supported the prisoners' resistance movement in Spain and Greece. The movement is accused of involvement in a string of church bombings and the letter bombing of a Carabinieri National Police Station in Milan, Italy, which occurred in late 1999 and in the summer of 2000. All those taken in for questioning were released after about 12 hours. 17 people will continue to be investigated under a severe anti-terror law. In the days prior to the raids, the Pinelli Social Center, an anarchist gathering space, and a memorial to Carlo Giuliani in Genoa, Italy, were targeted by firebombs, and 74 people, mostly North Africans, were deported as threats to society. More than 60 bicyclists departed from the town clock in Santa Cruz on the evening of Friday, September 21st, for the monthly Critical Mass bike ride.
We were out riding our bikes to show that bicycles are just as important as cars, that bicycling is a great alternative to using a car, and that bicyclists have just as many rights as a car does on the road, and that we pay taxes, so why can't we use a road just like a car?
Nicholas, an avid cyclist, was in the ride, and he explained that Critical Mass rides usually occur on the fourth Friday of the month, but this was a special event to celebrate World Car-Free Day. The monthly rides have historically been met with police officers on bicycles in tow with the riders, but on this day, the Santa Cruz Police Department was caught off guard. A little over 30 minutes into the ride, the cops moved in, as Freak Radio's Eon Blues explains.
There's an altercation between a woman and a police officer. They're telling everybody, don't ride in the left lane. And so he's riding up in the left lane, and he runs into her. He brushes up against her, and they arrested her. And then people laid down their bikes and stood in the streets and ended up blocking both lanes of traffic.
Some of the female riders also removed their shirts as a sign of solidarity with the arrested woman. After another 30 minutes of riding around town, the police moved in again.
They turned down immediately, they started crashing in, they arrested one person, and then, like, there was another guy who they pushed to the ground, and they had their clubs out, you know what I mean? They pressed their clubs against him.
That person was Nicholas. He was at the front of the ride and describes what happened next.
There were some cops following us from behind. We had just come up to Walnut Street, and all of a sudden, a line of cops on foot came out with nightsticks in hand. There were probably three or four cop cars on each side of the road, and then the cops just, you know, charged at us. Nick Richards charged at me, and I turned to the left to get out of his way, and all of a sudden I'm being thrown off my bike and slammed onto the ground. He jumps on top of me and just slugs me right in the face.
With his fist.
With his fist. I've got the mark right here on my cheek. He continued to press my neck against the pavement, and he was, like, jerking my arms behind my back and just slamming me around. You know, I was just, you know, kind of in shock at that point.
But unfortunately, the police weren't finished yet.
Another woman was standing with her shirt off, and she just was arguing with the cops, and they kind of surrounded her. She absolutely refused to walk away from the police officers, so they arrested her.
In all, six people were arrested on misdemeanor charges of obstructing or delaying an officer and impeding the flow of traffic. They were transported to Santa Cruz County Jail, where about 20 people held vigil into the night. The six arrested cyclists were all released from jail some 7 hours later. They all planned to file excessive force charges on the officers involved. And finally, about 50 people gathered in Santa Cruz for a rally at San Lorenzo Park on Saturday, September 22nd, to call for an alternative to the war fever sweeping across the nation. The hastily organized event was put together by the newly formed Santa Cruz Peace Coalition and featured a number of speakers who pointed out there is a growing skepticism about military strikes in retaliation for the September 11th terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. The rally culminated in a two-hour march through the streets of Santa Cruz, and no arrests were made. And those were headlines for the week ending Saturday, September 22nd, 2001. Since the September 11th terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, a racist backlash has occurred across the nation. More than 200 attacks against people who look Middle Eastern have been reported. Dozens have been wounded, and at least three people are dead. Nora Etka is a Palestinian-American student at UC Berkeley. She is a member of Students for Justice in Palestine and is also a member of the San Francisco chapter of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. She spoke with Freak Radio's Old Lady Scar Arms.
It's their responsibility of the media in tackling this issue, in tackling something so fragile and vulnerable at this moment when we could be going to war and inciting the xenophobia within our own borders when we should be healing, coming together, stepping back, maybe reevaluating how, you know, our system has been operating. Instead, we're trying to build up this anxiety and fear and that your neighbor could be your enemy. And look out. And, I mean, it's just really crazy to me. I was just telling some folks that a while back we were suffering from the Red Scare. Oh, anybody next to you could be a communist and you have to look out because he's out to get you. And now it's about the Green Scare. And that they could, these Muslims and Arabs, and they don't even pronounce it right. They don't even, I mean, the fact that Sikhs are being attacked, that's testament or testimony to the fact that this is a lack of knowledge. And this is the problem. And sensationalizing it in the media is only exacerbating the situation.
What would you say to those individuals that are targeting Arab Americans and others with such violence? I heard there was a man killed in Arizona.
Yeah, I also heard there was a Sikh man killed in Arizona. Number one, Sikhs aren't even Muslim, and they've had their own history with them, and they're from India. No, that's not the point. I don't know what I would say. We are all suffering right now. We are all enduring this pain, and all of us have some loss. And the way to react to it is towards coming together and reevaluation, and attacking one another is not the solution. Revenge shouldn't be a collective revenge either. If that's what people are out to get, it can't be anything collective. What governments do is separate from what people do, and what people have done is separate from what individuals are doing. And to collectively punish a whole group of people and based on their color and who they may be, if they look they're of Middle Eastern descent, or if they talk a language that sounds like they were, that's completely unfounded, and I have really nothing to say except that I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you've been this misled by the media, and I'm sorry that we're having to endure this at this point. But now, the way that we tackle it can either make the situation better or it can make it worse. And by attacking one another and by making it so dangerous. So here in the Bay Area, 70 Arab children on Thursday refused to go to school. They're that scared. People who are openly Muslim, either with hijab or beards or whatnot, are, you know, scared. On the Berkeley campus, Muslim women who wear the headscarves have to be escorted. This should not be the reaction. There was also the shooting of an Afghani woman in Fremont on Thursday. She was in front of a market, an Afghan market, and she was shot. I think she was 18 years old, had nothing to do with it. There was also, in a San Francisco church, a bag of pig's blood that was put in front of the door. I mean, these things are out of control. They're not something that we're talking about. This shouldn't have never happened to a civilized nation, this bombing. Well, a civilized nation also doesn't take on these tactics. We immigrants to this country have become citizens of this country. And first, third, you know, fifth generation citizens of this country, they're not going to go anywhere at this point. And we have a choice. We either deal with this and find some sort of reconciliation and realize that those people that are suffering, that are, you know, all of us are suffering this together. And not any one of us is immune. If there was going to be another attack on a federal building, let's say in San Francisco, there's not going to be some detector on Arabs and Muslims that's not going to hit them. We're all susceptible to this. It's absolutely ridiculous. And to think that we're not opposed to this, no one condones this kind of action. We're opposed to all attacks on civilians. We're opposed to all excessive military aggression, whether it's here in the U.S., whether it's in Palestine, whether it's in Iraq, as it has been for the past 11 years, wherever it is, if it's in Vieques with these bombings that they're practicing, the dropping of bombs, the practice in military areas, we do not condone any kind of military aggression, and that will not incite us to use it against those who are practicing it.
I didn't quite catch in the beginning, you said that there was Arab Americans and Islamic people in the World Trade Center when it was bombed,
yes,
or hit?
Yes, there were. There was at least 200.
How many?
The figures I've heard are up to 300.
300. What would you say to those of us who don't agree with these racist attacks? I know I personally feel kind of really saddened and almost paralyzed by this whole situation. What would you say to us? What can we do to help the Arab American people now?
Honestly, I say, you know, thank you, and thank you for staying true to yourselves, if anything. And there has been a lot going on, and it's been very, very obvious. Today in San Francisco, there was a beautiful rally sponsored by Global Exchange, and Spearhead was performing at it. Medea Benjamin spoke. Lots of coalitions, Barbara Lubin from Middle East Children's Alliance, Van Jones. A lot of people were speaking that we can't be doing this, and the suffering that people are going through here is the same as it's going on in Palestine and on in all third world nations. And so there has been effort to mobilize. And what the message that we're trying to get across is, despite these polls that most Americans do support war, even if it's going to cause unnecessary casualties, we do not agree. That is not representative of the majority of Americans right now. And if, you know, whether you express that through the rallies we're going through, there's going to be a rally on September 29th, a mass rally promoting, you know, do not practice with nuclear weapons right now. Do not go to war. It's a march that will go through the streets of San Francisco. And a lot of this is going to be on the website for the ADC, and you can check that out, www.adcsf.org. There's also another support list that's been created. It's called SF SLAM, which stands for San Francisco Solidarity List with Arabs and Muslims. But other than that, just keep in touch, keep updated, keep aware, talk to the people around you. Mm-hmm. Let them know that, you know, creating more hate and violence in this sphere is unfounded. Nobody wants this to happen again. It's not an us versus them situation. It's all of us.
I hear what you're saying. Okay, well, is there anything more you'd like to say?
No, that's about it. I mean, basically, that we have to unite. We have to prevent any kind of escalation right now in Western Asia and Central Asia. Right now, what we've done, because of what's going on right now, it's been an aversion from Israel's attack on the Palestinian civilian population. Obviously, this doesn't benefit us. Since Sunday, or since Tuesday, 30 Palestinians have been murdered. And nobody's noticed, and nobody can say anything because of what's going on the ground here domestically. And it's not that we've turned a blind eye, but that we're so consumed with, you know, recovering from this blow that we can't concern this. And really what I want to say is that we can't forget that we have to stay aware, that we have to end all types of aggression. And it should start in the Middle East, in Palestine, in Iraq. And, of course, it's going to stop it here as well.
In the biggest military mobilization since the 1991 Gulf War, the Pentagon on Wednesday ordered warships to the Persian Gulf region, and more than 350 fighter jets were deployed to bases in Kuwait, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia. President Bush has dubbed it Operation Infinite Justice. As the U.S. military gears up for war in Afghanistan, communities across the country have increasingly been calling for a peaceful solution to the conflict. On Wednesday night, more than 600 people turned out for a forum at the Pacific Cultural Center in Santa Cruz to address peaceful responses to the terrorist attacks. Stephen Zunes is an associate professor of politics and chair of the Peace and Justice Studies Program at the University of San Francisco. He serves as a senior policy analyst and Middle East editor for the Foreign Policy in Focus project. He spoke at Wednesday's forum.
This past week has brought out both the best of America and the worst of America. Those of us in the progressive community barely had time to grieve the horrific attacks of last week before we started to worry about the political implications of things that we believed in, like civil liberties, peace in the Middle East, military spending, including nuclear missile defense, immigrant rights. Indeed, I heard some Congress people talking about how we need this shows that we this national emergency shows we need to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and cut the capital gains tax. You know, we keep hearing the analogy of Pearl Harbor. But remember, after Pearl Harbor, tens of thousands of Japanese Americans, the vast majority of whom are loyal citizens, were rounded up and sent to internment camps. We need to fight to ensure the rights of Arab Americans and American Muslims from any kind of racist backlash. What happened last week was not an act of war, but a crime of unprecedented proportions. It may indeed require police action, even SWAT team commando-style operations, but does not require a war. Indeed, the efforts to bring people like that to justice have been hampered by the fact that our administration has blocked the creation of an international criminal court that could bring terrorists like this to justice. And I'm pretty scared what Congress did. Not just that they gave permission to go to war, not just that it was by such an overwhelming majority, but if you look at the text, it redefines war to include not just nation states, but individuals and organizations, a very dangerous precedent. It also essentially is an open-ended, no time limit, a Gulf of Tonkin kind of resolution, which gives virtually no limits of how long military operations can continue, including punishing for the strike to prevent future strikes, which gives a wide open interpretation for the people in the White House and the Pentagon to run with. Even more dangerous, it in many ways appears to have eliminated the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which forbids the military from taking action in domestic affairs which could be left to a civilian constabulary. So we're talking about a very dangerous resolution here. Not just giving permission to war, but read the text. It's pretty scary stuff. Sam Farr may be a bit off the hook because his daughter got married this weekend, so he didn't vote either way. But we need to really put on the pressure to make sure he doesn't support further resolutions such as this one. I mean, there's irony that bin Laden has become the enemy of the month. In fact, he's been similar to Slobodan Milosevic and Saddam Hussein and Manuel Noriega, and that they used to be friends of ours. Indeed, bin Laden and his network were trained initially by our central intelligence agencies in the refugee camps of Pakistan during the 1980s when they were allies with the Soviets. I want to emphasize something here in case there's any mistake whatsoever. Islam explicitly forbids the taking of innocent human life. It is a sin in Islam to commit suicide. Bin Laden has no more to do with Islam than Jerry Falwell has with Christianity. Now, there are a number of arguments against going to war. There's a pacifist argument based on the principled opposition of taking human life. There's the leftist critique that any U.S. Military intervention in the third world, by definition, is imperialistic. I admit I have sympathy with both of these perspectives, but I want to talk about the third, the pragmatic reasons, that this is not going to stop terror. This is not going to make us safer. There are several problems. First of all, poor intelligence. For example, 1998, the United States received word that Osama bin Laden controlled a chemical weapons plant outside of Khartoum, Sudan. President Clinton ordered it bombed. Ends up, it was a civilian pharmaceutical plant that supplied over half the antibiotics and vaccines to that impoverished African country. It led to a vast anti-American backlash and strengthened that country's Islamic fundamentalist dictatorship. Another problem is the cycle of violence. In 1986, the United States bombed two Libyan cities in retaliation for Libyan support for terrorist attacks against American interests in Europe. Not only did it kill more than 60 civilians, instead of curbing Libyan terrorism in retaliation, they blew up a Pan Am airliner over Scotland less than a year later. This related problem, of course, is what the Pentagon euphemistically calls collateral damage, the killing of innocent people, people just as innocent as those who died in New York City, not to mention survivors who will be bent on revenge. In order to stop this threat, and I do believe it is a real threat, the United States needs international cooperation. I realize that multilateralism isn't a strong suit of the current administration, but we really need the cooperation of other countries to bring the terrorists to justice and to break up their far-flung networks, which go well beyond Afghanistan, particularly in Central Asia, Middle East, and North Africa. If we make a precipitous military response, the willingness of those countries to cooperate us will be greatly lessened. International attention will not be focused on the terrorists where it belongs, but on the appropriateness or inappropriateness of the American response. The biggest problem, though, of course, is we're not fighting a government. If this was a government, military targets would be straightforward. Command and control centers, intelligence headquarters, major military installations. What we're dealing instead with here is a far-flung network of decentralized underground terrorist cells. There's not much in the way of tangible targets you can actually bomb. Now, there's been a lot of talk about attacking Afghanistan because the Taliban government of Afghanistan has been harboring Osama bin Laden. But this is not a classic case of state-sponsored terrorism. Osama bin Laden has more money than the Afghan government does. He's self-financed. He doesn't need their financial support. He has this wide network, thanks in part to the CIA, that he can hook up with. He doesn't need their logistical support. And furthermore, the Taliban is already heading way out of town, up into the hills. They're going to their underground bunkers. It's not the Taliban leaders who are going to get killed when the U.S. attacks. It's going to be innocent Afghans. And it raises, furthermore, the very fact that the first and foremost victims of the Taliban have been the Afghan people themselves. In other words, we really do need to protect our national interests, our national security from this threat. But that comes from a smart foreign policy, not foreign policy by catharsis, where we just lash out in anger and in revenge, and we stop thinking. The thing I want to emphasize, though, is even if we are successful, even if we capture or kill Osama bin Laden, break of his networks, there will be other terrorists to take his place. All the sophisticated weapons we have, all the brave fighting men and women, all the brilliant military leadership will be for naught as long as we have hundreds of millions of people in that part of the world that hate us. Only a minority support the tactics and methods of bin Laden, but many people resonate with his concern. You know, a lot of Americans are really upset seeing those pictures shown on CNN over and over and over again of Palestinians celebrating the attacks on Tuesday. First of all, there are only a small minority of Palestinians, and Arafat and the Palestinian Authority immediately ban such public demonstrations. But, you know, they weren't celebrating. I don't think these West Bank residents were alone in the Third World. There's this kind of perverse sense of satisfaction that for the first time the United States knows what it's like to lose thousands of civilians in an act of political violence. That's not new to the Palestinians. It's not new to the Vietnamese, the Salvadorans, the Nicaraguans, the Angolans, the East Timorese, the Lebanese, the Iraqis, who know this all too well, not in small part because of the policies of the United States. You know, seeing those heart-rending scenes of those anguished New Yorkers holding up pictures of their lost, missing loved ones, it looked very familiar. Los desaparecidos, the disappeared, the tens of thousands of victims of right-wing regimes in Latin America backed up by our own government. What we need to do is redefine security. I've traveled the Middle East for 20 or 30 years, and the more the United States has militarized the region, the less and less secure we have been. I think President Bush was wrong when he said we are attacked because we are a beacon of freedom. We do need to be proud, I believe, of our democratic institutions, but our foreign policy in the Middle East has been about the antithesis of freedom, supporting occupation armies, supporting autocratic regimes. If the United States put as much emphasis on a policy based on human rights, international law, sustainable development, as it did on arms transfers, punitive sanctions, airstrikes, and an ongoing military presence, not only would it be more consistent with our principles, we'd be a lot safer as well. In conclusion, it's not our values, but the abandonment of our values that has made us a target. We must recognize that America's greatest strength is not in our armed forces or our far-flung military might, but in the fortitude, the caring, and the noble values of its people. Thank you.
You're surrounded by a world's worth of things you just can't excuse. You've got a hard cough of a chain smoker, and you're at the Arctic Circle playing strip poker, and it's getting colder and colder every time you go ahead, make your next bold move. Tell us what's the next thing you need to prove to yourself.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the weekly Freak Show on Lake 101.7 FM in Muskego, Wisconsin. Please have a pen and paper ready to take down our contact information at the end of this one-hour broadcast. That was Ani DeFranco with this week's Spotlight Sound, Your Next Bold Move, from her 2001 double CD, Reveling Reckoning. Brian Wilson is a political activist and author who is currently writing a memoir of his life experiences, from being in the Air Force during the Vietnam War to becoming a nonviolent revolutionary. In April 1969, Brian witnessed the destruction of a Vietnamese village and the killing of women and children by U.S. troops. This experience awakened him emotionally and politically. He became an anti-war activist, tax resister, and in the 1980s used his own body to block trains loaded with U.S. weapons headed for Central American killing fields. In 1987, a weapons train in Concord, California, rolled over Brian. He lost his legs in the incident. Brian's many articles on U.S. foreign policy and nonviolent action can be seen on the web at www.brianwilson.com. He was interviewed by Freak Radio's John Malkin.
What was your immediate response when you first heard about what had happened 1 week ago?
Well, in the very first seconds I heard the news, which was at 6:30 in the morning, which would be 9:30 Eastern Standard Time, I didn't think I'd heard the news correctly. I was actually hearing George Bush's voice on BBC, and he said something about terrorists. We've been attacked by terrorists with planes into the World Trade Center. Both buildings were hit. And at first I was kind of aghast. It was shocking, and I thought maybe this was some peculiar joke that was being played on BBC in something. I mean, I was half asleep, too. I was just, so, you know, I was shocked, like I'm sure everybody was. And on the other hand, even though I was shocked, it was a spectacular event of horrific proportions. I have been to 25 countries studying U.S. policy, and I, in addition to having been in Vietnam, where I witnessed hundreds of Vietnamese being bombed and killed and maimed totally indiscriminately, and then having been to many countries where there's incredible, devastating results from U.S. policy. For years, I've been saying, and I've even written several essays on my website, how can we continue as a nation to get away with the policies that are so demonic that we can't even acknowledge them? That's why the whole Cold War was dominated by a concept called plausible deniability. We couldn't even tell the public of the United States, the only public that was really kept in the dark, what our policies were, the nature of them, the extent of them, and how much damage they were doing to local cultures and communities. So for years, I've been saying, I wonder when and how all of this is going to come back to haunt us in the United States, because the vast majority of the people of the world, which is perhaps 65 to 70%, are in misery. And as they've tried to organize or tried to develop autonomous local structures apart from any capitalist structure, that's considered a threat, and therefore is the Zapatistas. That becomes an alternative model to this monolithic neoliberal model, and it's not acceptable, and usually people are either wiped out or assimilated through bribes or terror. So I have said, and I've written, every time, every year that goes by that our policies don't change, which really they can't without a change in the whole consciousness of the culture in terms of our lifestyle, the tremendous demands our lifestyle make on the Earth's resources outside of our boundaries, every year our policies continue unchecked, increases the risk of U.S. citizens being hurt by rage. And this was, to me, this is a wake-up call that provides us an opportunity to reflect as never before why this happened, and not just to say, well, it's a product of some evil thought in a few people's minds. These people are not mentally ill. They may be obsessed with their own ideology, just like we're obsessed with our ideology, but they are evolving out of a context where there's decades of double-speak policies, double-standard policies, and violent policies by the United States that have been applied all over the world to some people and not to others. So, you know, we really need to be asking the question, why? And how does it relate to our attitudes, our policies, our collective lifestyle that demands an imperial foreign policy? I mean, we cannot live the way we live without an imperial policy, because we have 4.5% of the world's population. We consume at the minimum 25% of world's resources, and sometimes approaches half the world's resources. And that demands, that requires us to actually go to the world and kind of steal what we need and make it sound noble. So we have to have a rhetoric that makes it sound okay. Otherwise, we literally couldn't do it because it would bother us.
One interesting problem is that I think largely a lot of people are asking the question why, but of course the answer to most questions, people are coming up with different answers. And in fact, some people are saying the answer to that question why is we don't have enough security, we don't have enough military, we don't have enough intelligence abroad and even domestically. How do you respond to that answer?
I would say that the more we stress military security and intelligence, I mean, I'm not saying that we don't need to be somewhat mindful and vigilant about protecting our resources. The problem is that the global resources are so disproportionately distributed, skewed to Europe and North America, that how can you rationalize continuing to defend and protect this little privileged island in the globe surrounded by incredible misery? I would say if we really wanted to have security, we would announce to the world that we're reviewing all of our policies of the 20th century from the standpoint of people that have been bringing certain grievances to us. We are going to travel the world and listen to what people have to say about us, and we are going to begin to redress some of the harm that we have done in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America, and begin a new era of a mutual respect. That would bring more security and more peace than all of the NSA electronic eavesdropping, more FBI agents, more wiretapping, allowing the CIA now to assassinate. After all, I could be assassinated. Castro could be assassinated if you just open it up. One of the problems, psychological problems, is that when you're rich, surrounded by misery and impoverishment, you really do get paranoid, because you know that you have to protect your privilege from those that are without. And it also leads to imagining all kinds of things that are happening that aren't even happening, but you have to be on your guard to protect your riches from the majority who are impoverished. That is why there's no long-term security in this world until everybody feels justly treated. And that requires a genuine two-way dialogue and listening. Two-way, meaning us included in the discussion and everybody else included in the discussion, where we actually listen and don't pretend that we are better than others, that we deserve more than others, that God is on our side. I mean, God isn't on our side anymore than it is on the Muslim side. You know, so we have two kind of versions of fundamentalism. In this case, we have Islamic fundamentalism and Western capitalist fundamentalism, which is Christian, basically. Actually, the Muslims are also somewhat capitalist, but we have basically Muslim fundamentalists and Christian fundamentalists, and it's kind of a clash over resources and attitudes about other people. You know, it's really not too complicated at the root of it. I mean, it gets complicated because there's so many agendas that people are attached to. But when you really look at it kind of from the moon or space, it's like, wow, there's a really bad picture there. I mean, there isn't from space, but when you get down on the ground, it's a bad picture. When you get up in the space, you see one Earth. And then maybe that would help us develop some humility as human beings. That would be a tremendous boost for our security. That's not what, you know, our political leaders have in mind. It wouldn't matter whether they're Democrats or Republicans, of course. I mean, this is a capitalist system, and it's owned by the rich and whichever party's in power. So, I mean, you know, we're talking about a consciousness shift, and I just hope that this horrific event leads to a kind of soul search that might begin to break down Western rigid ideology.
It is a frightening event and a very dramatic event, and it has the potential to move people in a lot of different ways, and already has exhibited that. And a lot of people feel moved to action in a variety of directions, some of those in directions that look like they'll conflict shortly. What is your notion of action or even non-action right now?
Well, as I have gotten older, I'm 60 now, I've become a little bit more Buddhist-like, although I'm not a Buddhist, and a little bit more Native American, and I'm not a Native American unless I go back. I mean, I guess we're all natives if we went back far enough, many generations, because we all came from the same parents, basically. But I don't like to shout. I don't like to raise my voice. I don't like to shake my fist. And yet I have very intense feelings, for which I'm diagnosed now with post-traumatic stress disorder from Vietnam, so I regularly see a shrink to help me manage my feelings so that I'm not destructive to myself or others. But my tendency is to go internal and feel the heaviness of things. I think that, you know, different strokes for different folks. There's going to be two major, I think, public demonstrations at the end of this month that were already planned originally for other purposes and I think are being shifted to a new anti-war approach. I myself am using this time for a lot of reflection. Not only am I scared, of course, I've been scared to fly really my whole life, so being fearful of flying is really an old pattern for me, and I've even sought out help for it because there are certain times I felt I had to fly to do certain parts of my work. But I'm composing a letter now to Sam Farr, which I'm only probably one-fourth done, in which I want to explain the intensity of my feelings, which are not consistent with the flag-waving approach, and get behind our leaders and get behind our country. I don't like the approach that our political leaders are taking, a military approach, and Bush's rhetoric is particularly inflammatory, that this is a war of good versus evil, where the good, of course, and others are evil. For years I've been saying we're so evil that it's beyond comprehension as a nation collectively. And want Osama bin Laden dead or alive without any concern about even proving whether he's really behind it or not. I mean, this is just the approach of this rapid retaliation with using military force. I just find that so abhorrent and so likely to increase the incidence of destructive acts directed against us than to relieve it. It's likely to create more rage in the world. So I think people have to do however they feel they need to respond. Myself, I'm thinking about going on a long reflective fast. I don't want to do anything quickly. I'm tempted to always say, oh, I should be doing something. But there's another part of me that says, I need to pause. I need to think really clearly and also feel a lot of the various feelings of my own anger, my own sadness, my own grief. I live with several hundred dead Vietnamese in my mind every day. This has been going on for 32 years, and it's kind of a grounding experience for me to realize just how horrible war is, and all these people were civilians, every one of them. So, obviously, I don't want more people to be killed, and I do believe there's a different approach than the typical U.S. American approach. And so I would hope that people, whether they're going to be in demonstrations or not, and I think public expressions are very important, I think that we nonetheless need to really think through how we want to integrate all of this incredible, really, information, horrific events, historical contexts, our own political system that is totally plutocratic and oligarchic. We need to address these issues here. And although we want to stop insane retaliatory measures that they talk about one man, although they talk about a nebulous network, and I'm not disputing that there's a network of people that have planned things to attack the West, but we need to talk to people as to why they feel this way about the West and listen to them. So we need to listen, and we need to also not, I believe we need to stop recognizing that we have a democracy, that we have a system of laws. We don't. We have a system of plutocratic leaders representing the rich, and their policies are what inflame people around the world, and yet the majority of people in this country are rallying behind policies of oligarchs. And so I think part of this reflection period, we need to actually re-examine what the focus of our demonstration is beyond one particular policy, which is really part of a whole bigger picture of who we are as a people in this country, because the real war is here, not in Afghanistan. And I think, you know, the Taliban, which is so maligned, made a very incredibly reasonable statement today. They offered a solution. If the United States furnishes substantial evidence to show bin Laden's complicity in planning these acts of terror that we call them. I call them retail terrorists versus our wholesale terrorism around the world. They will turn him over to a neutral Islamic tribunal. Now, that's far more reasonable and to the point of justice than sending in jet fighters, bombers, paratroopers. Soviet Union couldn't even succeed in Afghanistan. It's very rugged territory, although the military says there's no triple canopy like in Vietnam. There's incredibly rugged, rocky mountain terrain with thousands of caves, not even dozens. And the Russians were defeated in Afghanistan with all their helicopters and bombers and ground soldiers. So we're going to inflame at least half the Muslim world, and maybe the half the Muslims that aren't inflamed at the West will become inflamed if we start killing innocent civilians in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on the Party Town Streaming Network online at www.partytown.com/radio. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to FRSC@microradio.net. That's FRSC@microradio.net, or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Or call area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A-Info's Radio Project for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For Old Lady Scar Arms, John Malkin, Eon Blues, and everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.